Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the latest public lecture at the LSE, and this evening given by the Secretary of State for International Development, Hilary Baer. And this will be a lesson to Hilary for going to Hull.
That's true.
Hull is probably one of the most remote and inaccessible places that you will visit during your time as Secretary of State for International Development. But what happened was that in 2 days after Hillary's appointment had been announced, the two of us happened to be on the same Any Questions panel with David Davis in Hull. And I, of course, took immediate, shameless opportunity, advantage of this opportunity, to ask him if he'd come and speak at the school. And in a weak moment over dinner, he agreed. So it's taken a little time to get the right date, but here we are, and we're very pleased to see you here. The career of Hillary, which I won't go through in any enormous detail, shows that there is still life in British local government, because he spent 20 years as a councillor on Ealing Council before entering Parliament as recently as 1999 as member for Leeds Central. He was then, however, brought into the government very quickly in 2001 and spent 2 years as a junior minister in DFID under, now I was about to say the name of the former Secretary of State, but I gather that a Ministry of Defence D-notice has been issued and that her name cannot now be mentioned on pain of police action. But after 2 years under Clare Sh- under, oh, sorry, he then had a brief spell in prison as prisons minister at the Home Office before returning to the department as Secretary of State near the end of last year. The interest in development issues in the school, Hillary, is very great, as you will see by the numbers of people here this evening. So we are all agog to hear your plans for the future of the department. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Howard, for that introduction. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. First of all, can I thank you for the invitation that you proffered in Hull. It's a great pleasure for me to be here. You mentioned one of my illustrious predecessors, Clare Short. And of course, apart from Clare and Valerie Amos, who followed her, and Linda Chalker, who preceded her, and going back in Labour history, one can think of Judith Hart and Barbara Castle, who all occupied this job, which did lead my Norwegian colleague, Hilda Jonsson, who I met in New York in September. She said, "Ah, Hillary, I see the government has failed to find another woman to fill this post, but at least they found a man with a woman's name." Which incidentally does explain why the day after I was elected to Parliament in a by-election in 1999, a very enthusiastic police officer bounded up to my father in the Palace of Westminster to offer his congratulations on the fact that his wife had just been elected as the Member of Parliament for Leeds Central. But it is a real pleasure to be here tonight, both because I'm aware of the work which your Crisis States Research Centre undertakes, and as you hear what I've got to say this evening, you'll understand why I've made that reference, but also to talk about the challenge that states that don't work pose for the achievement of the Millennium Development Goals. Now, the first Millennium Development Goal comes due next year, and in 2000, the international community promised that by 2005, we would ensure that girls and boys would have equal access to school. We'll miss that target. 2005 will also remind us that there's only a decade to go to 2015, when the remaining 17 targets set out in the Millennium Development Goals are due. And the truth is that if we don't work faster and better and harder, with more money and greater impact, we are going to miss the 2015 targets as well, on child mortality, on primary education, and on maternal health. And the truth is that this poor rate of progress is, frankly, unacceptable. It should shame the world, and we have to do something about it. Now, on current forecasts, sub-Saharan Africa will not achieve the target for reducing child mortality until 2165, which will be 150 years late. Why? It's not because the knowledge to avoid these child deaths doesn't exist. It's not that the drugs don't exist. It's not that the expertise doesn't exist. What's missing is the political will and capacity to make it happen. Now, why are we not doing better? Perhaps slightly perversely, the first thing I want to say is that we have made some progress. Life expectancy in developing countries has increased by 19 years to 64 years of age in the last four decades, in the period actually since Barbara Castle was Overseas Development Minister in the 1964 Labour government. The percentage of people with access to clean water, this thing here, has doubled since 1975. In Bangladesh, more than 1,300 people are lifted out of extreme poverty every day. In just the last 5 years, Mozambique has managed to double the number of children in school and to reduce poverty from 70% to 55% of the population. China is on track to become a middle-income country. India looks like it will do the same. And we are very close to eradicating polio in the world. Not quite, one more heave, but we're close to doing it. And in truth, if you went back to the end of the Second World War and said to people at that time, when polio was a source of great fear in many communities, that we in 50 years' time will be close to eradicating polio, people would have said that would be a real achievement, and we're nearly there. In truth, developing countries have achieved so much in 30 years, as much in 30 years, as the industrial world managed in more than a century. But, and it's a very, very big but, millions of people are being left behind. 1.2 billion of our fellow human beings on this small and fragile planet that we share with them today lack access to this because they have no clean water. 113 million children in the world have no classroom, no desk, no textbook, no teacher, no window on the world because they don't go to school. Millions of children die each year from diseases we know we can prevent. HIV/AIDS is in some countries in the process of wiping out all of the gain in life expectancy which has been achieved in the last 40 years. And we have a generation of grandparents looking after a generation of grandchildren because the generation in between, their children's generation, is in the process of dying. And what is it we as parents wish for more than anything else? It is that we should die before our children do, because it is the natural order of things. And all of these are experienced, particularly by people living in weak or failing states. Poor people are frontline victims where the state is unable or unwilling to carry out its basic functions. At their worst, crisis states kill people as well as killing development. Now, the chances of improving health and education in a state which is at war are frankly pretty remote. And the last decade has witnessed appalling conflicts around the world, including throughout Africa. According to the International Rescue Committee, some 3.3 million people died in the Democratic Republic of the Congo between 1998 and 2002, directly as a result of state crisis. No wonder people have described it as Africa's hidden First World War. And indeed, before the television cameras went into Bunia last summer, if you had said to most people in this country, could you please name the country in the world where 3.3 million people have lost their lives in the last 4 or 5 years, very, very few people would have been able to say the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Crisis states also harm their neighbors. People flee their homes, illegal migration rises, trade and investment flows are disrupted, violence spreads and becomes much harder to contain. Now, there are, of course, many different types of weak and failing states. The Democratic Republic of the Congo and Somalia are at one end of the spectrum. At the other end are states that are plagued by poor governance or the use of political office for personal or criminal ends. In between are states that have fragile institutions, states that struggle to manage social tensions or fundamental challenges to central authority. Other countries can, in one sense, be highly effective, but suffer from repressive or isolationist regimes that actually inhibit development and contain the seeds of more fundamental failure. Finally, as Haiti has recently demonstrated, countries can move in and out of crisis quite quickly. A year ago, Haiti was not really on the world's radar screen. Today, it certainly is, and we can see all too clearly its weakness. Conversely, Rwanda and Mozambique show how countries can move out of crisis to provide basic security and begin to raise the living standards of the poorest people. Now, weak and failing states have one thing in common. They are unable or unwilling to secure broad and sustainable development for their citizens, and they represent the single biggest challenge we face in fulfilling the promise that we made in 2000 to achieve the Millennium Development Goals by 2015. Now, one measure of the effectiveness of states can be drawn from the World Bank's country policy and institutional assessment indicators. These measure economic management, the strength of public institutions, and the policy commitment to poverty reduction. There are 46 countries that have had the worst performance on these indicators over the last 4 years. They contain, these 46 countries, a small part of the world's population, but a huge share of the people living in absolute poverty. These countries account for only 14% of the global population, yet they contain 41% of all child mortality in the world. These same states contain 343 million people living on less than a dollar a day. What, 67 pence or so. This is 59% of all absolute poverty in the world outside India and China. That's almost as many people as those living in the European Union. And just imagine for a moment the entire population of the European Union living in absolute poverty. Imagine the wasted human potential. Imagine trying to lift the EU out of poverty without having effective states to maintain law and order, promote growth, and deliver services. Again, if we leave aside India and China, the same 46 states account for a half of all maternal deaths, a half of people without access to safe drinking water, and almost half of those 113 million children who currently aren't in primary school. Suddenly, we can see one of the main reasons why it's so hard, or proving so hard, to achieve the Millennium Development Goals, namely the concentration of the poorest in weak and failing and crisis states. Now, this is not just about statistics. The goals are a means to an end, a better life for people. And let's be absolutely clear, people will not have a better life as long as this crisis continues. And Thomas Hobbes was absolutely right when he said that without an effective state, there could be no learning, no society, that people are racked by continual fear, and that the life of the individual is often nasty, brutish, and short. And this really brings me on to what is the main message I wished to put to you this evening, and the main argument I wish to advance. If we don't do something to promote more effective states, then we really have no hope of achieving the Millennium Development Goal. No hope of lifting people out of absolute poverty. No hope of enabling more children to grow up so they can actually celebrate their fifth birthday because they haven't died of diseases that we know that we can treat but lack the means. So what should we do? Now, we are responding to the problem on many fronts, but tonight I just want to highlight four issues. The first is we need to understand the cause of state failure, state weakness, state crisis better. And here I want to congratulate the LSE Crisis States Research Programme on doing precisely that. Because your focus on explaining why some states experience conflict, instability or stagnation is exactly on target. We need your answers, we need your help to assist us in understanding better what can help states to emerge from crisis. Now, you are, in doing this work, addressing some really difficult questions. Why has economic liberalisation been accompanied by stability and improvement in Uganda, for example, while Zimbabwe has experienced increasing instability and poverty. So much so that a country which, a generation ago, was known throughout Africa as the breadbasket of that continent, cannot today feed its own population. What can be learned about the process of consolidating peace from the experiences of, say, Guatemala and Sierra Leone? What accounts for the relative progress in confronting the AIDS crisis in countries like Senegal or Uganda, and much slower progress in other countries? Now, in truth, each country has its own story and has to be understood in its own terms. In Nepal, a long-standing failure to address poverty has combined with problems of governance to fuel discontent and conflict. The humanitarian crisis in Kosovo was triggered by ethnic tensions, manipulated for political purposes. Afghanistan became vulnerable to war and international neglect when it fell victim to a regime driven by a narrow and zealous religious group following a generation in which its conflicts were fueled and armed by the politics of the Cold War. The Democratic of the Republic of the Congo was ruled by a kleptocracy for decades before regional warfare and competition for valuable resources drove it to the point of collapse. Now, the impact of all of this can often afflict entire regions and not just individual states. We have seen the contagion of conflict and criminality spread in West Africa from Liberia through Sierra Leone, Guinea and the Ivory Coast. The Balkans and the South Caucasus are other examples. But there are also wider lessons that we need to understand. Some people do rather well out of state crisis. Powerful people and groups can perpetuate ineffectiveness to advance their own personal and business interests. Idi Amin and Mobutu Sese Seko were two examples. International money laundering networks enable corrupt leaders to conceal revenues. Warlords could rely on the international markets to supply weapons and mercenaries at an affordable price. Now, the LSE Crisis States Programme is looking at the ability of institutions to respond to social and economic challenge. This is absolutely central. Crisis states have often had a long history of institutional weakness and poor governance. The second thing that we need to do is to act earlier to prevent state crisis. This means getting better at predicting when states are heading for crisis so that we can decide whether and how to act. The Department for International Development is working closely with the Prime Minister's Strategy Unit and other government departments to try and improve our ability to identify when states are at risk of instability or collapse. This doesn't mean that we will always be able to intervene or do something about it. Sometimes others will need to take the lead. DFID is also sponsoring research that is starting to show that development aid to prevent crisis is much less expensive than the cost of reacting afterwards. Prevention makes profound economic good sense. More importantly, it can save lives and promote development. Better prevention also means staying involved with states that are either in trouble or heading for trouble. For long, donors have been too quick to pull out when things go wrong. But as Afghanistan and the DRC have shown, walking away can sometimes carry a very high price. Now, one way to stay involved is to develop long-term development partnerships. And at DFID, we have made real progress on this front in the form of partnership framework arrangements. These are long-term agreements with developing countries such as Rwanda and Sierra Leone that ensure predictability of aid over a 10-year period. They enshrine mutual rights and responsibilities. We look to our partners to be serious about poverty reduction and good governance, and in turn we commit to predictable aid flows and to be held accountable for our assistance. And along with the international community, we do need to shed the culture of short-term response and build a long-term relationship. Thirdly, we need to do more to ensure that the safety and security of citizens is the foundation of development. There will be times when military force is the only way to protect human life. Think of our operations in Sierra Leone and Kosovo, or the French in the Ivory Coast. But we need also to be better at protecting human security in other ways. Support to effective and accountable policing, for example, is an important part of development. Good policing that protects human rights is as important as primary education, clean water, and healthcare. In some cases, perhaps even more so. Development and security also intertwine at the global level. Crisis states that house criminal networks, harbour terrorists, or engage in the trafficking of drugs or people undermine the world's collective security. Global prosperity, our prosperity, other people's prosperity, depends on global security. Development without security is impossible. Security without development can only be temporary. Fourthly, we must recognise that no agency can act alone. DFID is working closely with the Ministry of Defence, the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, and the Prime Minister's Strategy Unit to try and create a common framework for supporting effective states. We are aiming to devise an integrated approach that combines development programmes with diplomatic engagement and work on security. And the common goal is to reduce the risk of state crises. Now, of course, we have to work in partnership, both internationally and regionally. The United Nations, the World Bank, the OECD are important partners. We've seen that NATO and regional bodies such as the Economic Commission of West African States can be critical. It was ECOWAS which sent the force into Liberia that has helped to stabilise the position in Monrovia and other parts of the country with some support from the Americans. The proposals for a common EU security strategy show promise for a more integrated response as well, as do Paul Nielsen's plans to fund peace support operations in Africa through the European Development Fund via the African Union. And in Burundi at the moment, the AU has a force there trying to promote peace and stability, and DFID has recently given additional financial support to enable that force to remain in place. And finally, 2005, just thinking ahead to next year, will be a year of enormous challenges and also a year, I believe, of great expectations. Because it will be a decisive year for multilateralism, not least because of the UN's conference in the autumn of next year to review progress towards the Millennium Development Goals. It will be the year that the UN responds to Kofi Annan's high-level panel. And when Kofi Annan addressed the UN General Assembly last September, and I was there to hear his speech, he said, in effect, look, if you don't want countries to be taking action unilaterally, then the United Nations has got to become more effective at doing the task that the world community gave it when it was established at the end of the Second World War. And now is the chance for the UN to do that, to identify state crisis in advance, to work more effectively in cooperation with the World Bank and others to prevent crisis and to act decisively when human security is at risk. And of course, 2005 will also be the year in which the UK will hold both the chair of the G8 and the presidency of an expanded European Union. A great opportunity to show leadership, but also a great responsibility at a time when the whole world will be watching to see what we do. And it is a time when we need to recognise as a world community our obligation, our moral, our political, our social obligation to do something about the circumstances that people who live in these states find themselves in. Because when we come to the end of 2005, the world will not just have watched, but the world will have judged, and the world will have judged all of us by what we do. And it is essential that we rise to that challenge and show that we are capable of working with others to improve the lives of millions of our fellow human beings. And I look forward to working with you and others in actually rising to that challenge. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much, Hillary. And the Secretary of State has kindly agreed to take questions, and that does not usually cause a difficulty in this place. But I'm looking for the first volunteer. Yeah, right up in the corner there as a start. Thank you. If you could give your names beforehand, that would be helpful.
Hello, my name is Richard Johnson. I'm a consultant. Is your government going to do something to stop the Zimbabwean opposition party from being tortured and killed? as was depicted in Sunday's Panorama program, or are you just going to sit around and watch that happen?
Okay. Do you want to take them individually or in groups?
Let's take two or three from, from upstairs first. So take one down here, and then one across there, yeah.
Nick Smith, a former Labour Party official. Really along the same lines as the last question, which is political parties are very often the foundation for democracies in strong states, and interested in Hillary's view about support for political parties to ensure democracy and better governance.
We'll take one more. Woman just across there, and then...
Hello, my name is Zungs, and I'm final year undergraduate student. And I mean, I've heard you criticizing all the state crisis of Africa, but I just wonder what the UK could do in terms of, such an action like new partnership for Africa development. I mean, when the Africa take the initiative themselves to do something, then what the UK could trying to help them. I mean, just in terms of we always hear and trying to criticize them. I mean, just wonder when they take initiative themselves, then what would you do for that? And okay, that's it.
Thank you.
Right. Richard Johnson, first of all. Well, it's not the case that we're sitting around watching it happen. I was in Abuja at the beginning of December at the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting, where there was a very fierce debate about whether Zimbabwe should remain suspended from the councils of the Commonwealth or should be readmitted. Now, the UK argued very strongly, and in the end, the majority of the Commonwealth agreed that Zimbabwe should remain suspended from the councils of the Commonwealth. Not all the Commonwealth countries that were there shared that view. I have to say I found their arguments very surprising, given the facts on the ground in Zimbabwe. 600% inflation, huge unemployment, a country so brought to its knees that it is incapable of feeding its own population. So this year, the UK, alongside the rest of the international community, will be helping to feed around 6 million Zimbabweans. Now, because there happens to be a rotten government in Zimbabwe, we also have programs on HIV, AIDS and health, because we feel it's important that we should provide that support. Secondly, there are the EU sanctions, which you'll probably be aware of, which have recently been extended in terms of the individuals that they cover. But thirdly, in the end, a solution to the problem of Zimbabwe has to come from within the country itself. I don't think that crisis could continue for very much longer, because the country just simply isn't functioning. We have a responsibility, but so do others have a responsibility, including the neighboring states in Africa, to speak out about what is going on in Zimbabwe. Can I just answer the third question next, because it does link to that, which was your question about NEPAD, the New Partnership for African Development. I happen to think that NEPAD is one of the most important things to have come out of Africa in the last decade or so, or longer. Why? Because it is something that, if you could turn NEPAD over and look at the bottom, you'd find stamped on it the words "Made in Africa." I was at the AU summit in Maputo in July of this year, and I took away from that meeting a very, very strong sense of the countries of Africa committed to the New Partnership for African Development, getting on with the business of establishing its institution, making it happen. What is the essential element of NEPAD? It says to the developed world, look, you've got responsibilities towards us to help us to make the world trading system fairer, to increase the amount of aid, but we too have responsibilities to help ourselves. And because we also know that good governance and effective states and the things that I was talking about this evening are also fundamental to the prospects of improving people's lives and lifting them out of poverty. And it seems to me that that is the basis for a grown-up partnership between the developed and the developing world. And one example of that is the Peace and Security Protocol, which has now been ratified by sufficient member states, which is going to help build the capacity of Africa to do something about the conflicts in its own continent itself. And I, for one, welcome that unreservedly, because we need to build and develop that capacity. And if you look at Africa, of course, there are successes as well as problems. And it's important that we recognize that. That's why at the beginning of my remarks this evening, I talked about the extent to which we have made progress. And a country like Uganda on HIV/AIDS is a real success story, because they brought down the prevalence rate by a whole range of things, including strong political leadership. Now, Nick Smith, you asked about support for political
parties. Well, effective functioning political parties are, you know, fundamental to a thriving democracy. There's been the work, for example, which the Westminster Foundation has done. Now, historically, that has focused on particularly the former Soviet states. I recently met the Westminster Foundation shortly after I came back from the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And one of the thoughts I put to them was, could you do some work there to support these emerging democratic institutions, which are part of the transitional national government? The other thing I would say about political parties and democratic change is that it took us, as a country, it took us a really long time, you know, the last 2,000 years of our history, to kind of get to the point that we're at today with the democracy we have in the form that it takes. And we've, you know, made every mistake you could along the way, and we cut off a king's head in the process, and we've been involved in a lot of war and a lot of conflict. And sometimes I look at some of the developing countries with which we have a partnership, and I wonder, are we expecting too much too quickly? And the truth, I think, that we learn is, if you think in particular of the former Soviet states, it's one thing to have the institutions of a democracy, you know, a government that you can elect, a ballot box, a piece of paper on which you can put a cross. It's another thing to acquire the culture in which a democracy operates, like accepting that when you lose the election, you may hate it, you may think the electorate's got it completely wrong, but you say, okay, I'm out, the other person's in. And I learned that very forcefully, reflecting on my prisons experience, when a group of prison ministry officials came to see me at the Home Office because they're looking at prison reform. And I was describing the institutions here in the UK, and I talked about the Chief Inspector of Prisons. And I said, of course, the Chief Inspector of Prisons could never be sacked. And they perked up and they said, what is the, it's one of these transliterated Russian words, what is the mechanism which means that the Chief Inspector of Prisons can't be sacked? Because they couldn't quite understand that a minister would appoint someone who then produces deeply critical reports of the system that the minister's got responsibility for. And the answer, of course, is it isn't written down anywhere. Why? Because the press wouldn't have it, Parliament wouldn't have it, and that's the culture in which our democracy operates.
Thanks. We'll stay up in that corner because there were a couple more there. Thank you. Yep. Yeah, that'll be fine. Thanks.
Patrick McCausland. The most successful state in Africa in terms of bringing itself back from failure to being a viable political entity with a reasonably thriving economy is the Republic of Somaliland. Why won't the British government recognise the Republic of Somaliland and give it aid?
And then one couple of rows in front, yeah.
Bernard Herrmann, in spite of the enormity of Africa's natural resources, why do you think such a disproportionate level of state misdevelopment has to be found in that continent?
And then one more just over there in the middle. Thank you.
That's a tough one, yeah.
Tom Ketley, International Relations undergraduate. You outlined the need for DFID to become more involved in preventing state failure and raising states out of failure once it's begun. How do you intend to deal with states who refuse to take development aid as they see it as a form of neo-imperialism?
Right, this is a sort of set of exam questions, except you have to eat, you have to answer all the questions and not choose one out of three.
Blast. Right, Somaliland, which was your question. Well, we do give some aid, is the first answer to your question. Indeed, we had a debate on Somaliland in Westminster Hall that I responded to about 3.5 weeks ago. This was following the visit to Hargeisa of a number of members of the International Development Select Committee, and they put to me exactly the question that you've put to me tonight about recognition. I mean, the honest answer is, question, is it for the UK to take the lead on the question of Somaliland's status? I'm sure the other neighbouring countries in Africa would have a view on that. But in saying that, I recognise what the people of Somaliland have been able to achieve in providing stability and a functioning state and a democracy, while in the rest of Somalia we see demonstrated very clearly state weakness, state failure, state crisis, as you'll be only too well aware, although there has been
the signs of some progress in the negotiations that have been taking place, which DFID has helped to fund. But the truth is we do give some financial support, and we are, and about, we think about 40% of that actually goes to Somaliland as well as other bits of Somalia, and we are in the process of preparing what we call a country engagement plan, because we are asking ourselves precisely the question, what more can we do in relation to Somalia in general and Somaliland in particular in response to the circumstances that now obtain there. Bernard, your second question, you know, why? That is a really tough question. Because I don't have the answer to your question, and secondly, because it, you know, goes to the heart of what's happened in the continent. What I would just say about resources is that resources, you know, could be, natural resources can be a great mixed blessing, and it depends very much how they're used, who gets the benefit, and how the money is spent. And one of the things that we have been trying to promote as the UK is something called the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative, which the Prime Minister launched at the World Summit on Sustainable Development in 2002. And in essence, what that says is, you know, please sign up to publishing what you pay to governments if your company is extracting natural resources from a country, and governments, please publish what you then use the money on. And that is to try and overcome some of the real difficulties that we've seen in some places as a result of the exploitation and use of resources, people creaming off the money, and all of the things that have happened. But what your question also demonstrates, of course, is the enormous potential that there is within Africa. And what Africa needs as much as anything else is economic development. And this is the continent which cannot hold on to almost half the savings it generates every year. And yet we know if Africa is going to meet the Millennium Development Goals, it's got to grow at 7% a year, and we're not achieving that. So that is a really, really big challenge for all of us. Tom, I think it was. Third question, what do we do about countries that refuse to take aid? Have you got a particular country in mind? So, no, seriously. Oh, in the future. Yeah. Well, it's that too is an extremely difficult question, because it means that you, as far as a development conversation, a development relationship is concerned, you've got a problem. Now, the truth is, it depends what the country is and what it's doing. And if one looks at Afghanistan and the consequences of what went on there during the time of the Taliban, who were, of course, profoundly anti-developmental, not least because one of their policies was that half of the next generation of Afghanistan shouldn't have access to the most effective means of improving people's lives and lifting themselves out of poverty, namely the chance to go to school, because they didn't allow girls to go to school. Now, there were some very heroic people in Afghanistan who carried on running the schools in private at great personal risk, because they believed passionately in the right of half of the next generation of Afghanistan to have the chance of an education. And now, what, 37% of the kids who go to school are girls, and that's a transformation compared to what the situation was before. But a lot of pain and suffering and blood was spilt in order to get to that point. I think the really fundamental question the world has to answer is this. At what point does the notion of state sovereignty no longer protect a state from having to account to the world, A, for what it's doing to its own citizens, and B, for what it's doing to the citizens of neighbouring countries or the threat that it presents? And it seems to me that encapsulates the challenge which the high-level panel has been given by Kofi Annan. And the world needs to be more effective in finding answers, not least because in this small and increasingly fragile planet, no longer could, if we ever hoped that we could, no longer could we hope to isolate ourselves from events in one country, because increasingly they have an impact on us wherever we happen to live.
We'll come downstairs. You sometimes get slightly easier when it's in the stalls, I've discovered. And, the fourth row woman there, yeah. No, one in front, and then man two away. Those two were waiting. Thanks.
Hello. My name is Anais. I'm student in development in Destin here at LSE. You said that development could help address the challenge of state failure. However, you did not define what you understood by development, and nor did you define the kind of policy recommendations that you think belong to development agenda of Britain. As a development student, I mean, we all know that development in itself is a very contentious issue, and that policy recommendations are very contentious as well. Currently, we have pretty much a neoliberal agenda among international institutions and G7 donors to which Britain belong. Also, a good governance agenda attached to that. And I would like to know, don't you think that this agenda actually plays a role in reinforcing the failing of states insofar as it reduces their potential for building institutional capacity? And I think, for example, about neoliberal economic reforms, about disastrous consequences that social adjustment programs have had, and a lack of effective answer to these failures. The imbalance in the world economy, which is pretty much due to the G7 clinging to their privileges, to which Britain belongs, and the bias against developing countries that exist in international institutions, and none of the G7 countries has ever been willing to reform that. So what do you think about that?
Thanks. Just yeah, too long. And then the man with the rather splendid umbrella over there who's been patient.
Good evening. Hi, I'm Diego Navarra. I'm doing a PhD in information systems in my second year, but I come from Destin. So I'm trying to do a combination of these things. It has been very interesting to hear tonight your perspective of results, achievements with respect to the Millennium Development Goals in a number of countries. Then, beside that, I would like also to learn more about your outlook with regard to the internet, to the roles, responsibilities, and accountabilities of donors, the international community, and development organizations in the Middle East.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The third one will have the umbrella.
Hi, my name is Andrew Bamba. My name is Andrew Bamba. I'm with the University of Westminster and also a member of a thriving political party. If I could just ask you, don't you think it's morally wrong for this government, this country, to take doctors and other professionals from developing countries in order to make up for shortfalls in our own capacity?
Thank you.
Right. Your first question. I was interested in when you said that, I think I quote you right, when you said, you know, the notion of development is quite controversial. On structural adjustment programs and the prevailing philosophy of the 1980s and parts of the 1990s, you're, of course, absolutely right. And one of the things which the international community is slowly, some less slowly than others, is coming to realize is that didn't work. And the approach now, with the support for country ownership, for poverty reduction strategy papers, and the way in which we work as a development organization is to try and support developing country governments in achieving the things that they want to achieve. There is a debate to be had about conditionality. And a lot of the debate in development is about what kind of conditionality, because I think there are very few people who would say no conditionality at all. Simple argument as to why no conditionality at all isn't a very sensible policy. During General Abacha's term of office is not the right word, during his period of rule in Nigeria, the international community gave Nigeria $1 billion in aid. It is estimated, no one knows for sure, that he and his family stole from the people of Nigeria about $3 to $4 billion during the period of his rule of Nigeria. In those circumstances, did the poor people of Nigeria benefit greatly? No, they didn't. So it seems to me the debate, the real development debate, is about what is the right kind of conditionality. And I say that because all governments, however poor, face choices about how they're going to use their resources. Now, what aid is about is trying to support governments in doing the things that they have the, in one sense, the capacity to do, but lack the means. And that's why so much of our development aid program is about trying to build and support capacity in developing country governments, so that when you get to the point that if you had the money, you could actually spend it effectively, and not all governments are at that point, but they actually lack the cash to get more kids into school, to provide doctors in communities that don't have them, to extend the coverage of skilled medical personnel so that women with complications in pregnancy can actually be seen by someone who can help them. And when I was in Ethiopia 3 weeks ago, I visited a health center in a place called Makani Salam that serves 180,000 people. There isn't a doctor in the health center in Makani Salam, and when women with complications in pregnancy turn up, they can't help them, they refer them to the hospital 100 miles away. Problem is, there isn't any transport to get them to the hospital 100 miles away. There's a bus once a week if you can afford it. And that's the reality that many people experience in those circumstances. So that's the first thing. The second thing I would say is that you're absolutely right, we have obligations to not do things that make it more difficult for countries to develop. And that's why progress on the World Trade Talks is the single biggest step that we could take now to actually improve the lives of a lot of people living in developing countries. And the obligation on us is to honour the promises that we entered into in saying that we wanted to make the Doha round a development round, to overcome the failure in Cancun to make that happen, and to actually achieve a breakthrough, particularly on agriculture, when those talks come to resume. All I would say in passing is that the agreement reached with Margaret Beckett and other agricultural ministers last summer to break the link between production and subsidy, which was in the context of trying to reform the common agricultural policy over more than a quarter of a century, was historic in one sense, is a very good starting point. Do we need to go further? Yes, we do. Right, the second question was really about the Middle East. Yeah. Well, what do we do? We have a development program in the Palestinian territories, and I was there for 3 days in July of this year. It was the first time I had been. It really brought home to me, one, the appalling circumstances in which the Palestinian people find themselves, the terrible impact which the Intifada has had on people, communities, their ability to travel, to commute, to keep in touch with their families, to earn a living, because it's been a catastrophe all way round. And we provide support both to UNRWA and to the Palestinian Authority, which is working hard in very difficult circumstances to try and provide the manifestations of a state, although there isn't a Palestinian state currently. Clearly, the only solution to this problem is a negotiated settlement, which delivers two things. One is a state of Israel with the right to exist and the security which it wants for its people, and on the other hand, a Palestinian state. And while the international community can do a great deal to encourage, cajole, and persuade, in the end, the deal is going to have to be done between the political leaders of the Palestinian people and Israel. And all of the evidence and the experience we have from, well, they're not similar conflicts, because each conflict is individual in its history and its character. But all of the evidence is you need certain circumstances to obtain for an agreement to be reached, but they're going to have to find a way of living next door to each other, alongside and with each other. And what we can do in the process, and that's what we're seeking to do as DFID, is to provide support to the Palestinian people and the PA in the very difficult and harsh circumstances they find themselves in. Andrew, I think it was your question about doctors and nurses. Well, this is a really big question. Example, in Malawi, teachers are currently dying of HIV/AIDS faster than they can be trained. Now, what prospect of Malawi achieving the Millennium Development Goal to get all of its kids into primary school? Well, not much of a prospect when, you know, the mathematics, never mind the human reality, is working against that. As far as recruitment into the NHS is concerned, as I'm sure you are aware, there is an agreement which the NHS has not to recruit directly in developing countries. The problem is that that agreement doesn't apply to private recruitment agencies. There is also another problem, which is a more difficult one, which is what exactly does one say to individual nurses and doctors from developing countries who want to come and work here or in other developing countries for their own career development or better pay? Do we say, no, you can't do it as an individual? And there is a tension here. We've got a piece of work that I've initiated within the department to try and ask precisely the question that you've put. Is there more that we should be doing, both as the UK and as the international community? And I must say, reflecting on the situation in Malawi as an example at the moment, the problem, you know, in Malawi isn't, it's not a kind of a lack of policy, it's just a lack of people to do things, because not least because of the impact of HIV/AIDS, which is killing not just teachers, but doctors and MPs and police officers, and cutting a swathe through the capacity of the country. And I think one of the questions that we have to ask ourselves as development organizations is there more that we can and should be doing just to provide replacement capacity at the moment to enable this country to survive while it deals with the challenge of HIV/AIDS? And I think it's a really, really big question.
Now, there were several others down this part of... Gosh, yeah, there were lots of others. Woman in a white shirt and a red waistcoat, all right.
Hello, I'm Siddiqa Chaudhry. I'm from the British Bangladeshi International Development Group. And my question is, you made a point about how some individuals gain from states failing. And I was wondering that, do you acknowledge that other states also gain from state failure? And I'm thinking sort of state rebuilding. There's a lot of work to be done and a lot of economic benefit to be gained from that. So, and if you do acknowledge...
Are you thinking about somewhere in particular?
Let's say it's hypothetical. And if you do acknowledge that, then how do DFID, who have very positive aims and objectives, resolve working with other departments that are more concerned with the economic benefit of the state?
Okay. One man, the sort of grey thing.
George Nookturn, Hampton School. Recently,
sorry, I didn't catch your name.
George Nookturn.
George.
Yeah, thanks. You see, especially in the UK, a large number of migrants from less economically developed countries, and who send a great proportion of the wages back to the country where they come from, which often forms the majority of the cash coming into that country. How do you harness that cash flow as a whole to improve, boost the development of that country? Thanks.
Thanks. And one more over here.
Kevin Osborne. Hello. Kevin Osborne, yep. Institute of Latin American Studies. Hilary Benn has very clearly illustrated how warfare has damaged the development potential, especially within Africa. I would wonder whether he might like to comment on the loopholes in the arms trade, which are allowing arms to get through to rogue states within Africa and throughout parts of the world, and also to comment on the arms trade in general within the UK, which seems to be a matter of pride and not shame.
Okay.
Thank you.
Right, your first question, sorry. On corruption, if we're talking about individuals who gain, Transparency International does, a really sterling job in publishing its corruption index. And if you look at DFID programs in a number of countries, tackling corruption is a very prominent part of that, because one of the characteristics of a functioning state, or one that where we hope to have any prospect of improving people's lives, is that there shouldn't be a lot of corruption about. And it's an issue that has to be addressed. Now, it's, of course, best addressed by countries themselves recognizing that that is the case and rooting it out. And we're very keen to support countries that are doing precisely that. Second issue, and it was, you raised the question of aid being tied, in effect. Governments giving aid because contracts and services will come to its own country. Well, we, of course, in the UK, untied aid. One of the things that Clare Short did, of which we should all be very proud, because in April 2001, she untied British aid. So no longer is the giving of aid dependent on spending that money on goods and services. And the origin of that, and it's the legal basis of the International Development Act, was, of course, the Pergau Dam affair, when the previous government gave a lot of aid to this, as someone once described it, this dam project. Why did they give it? Not actually because it was in the development interest, but because it meant a lot of contracts for British companies. And if you do that, you're hopelessly confused as to why it is you're giving the support. And so breaking the link, which not a lot of other countries have done, is really rather fundamental. You were rather coy in saying it was a hypothetical question in relation to contracts and rebuilding other countries. Did you have a country in mind? Iraq. Okay, all right. Well, I thought that's what you were... I didn't think LSE students were quite that coy. And since no one has... You're just being polite. Since no one else has raised Iraq, I'll happily answer the question about it. I mean, at the moment, the international community is in the process of putting a great deal of financial support into the reconstruction of a country that has been traumatized and brutalized and impoverished by the experience of the last 30 years, courtesy in particular of the former ruler of Iraq, Saddam Hussein. Now, I went to Basra and Baghdad in September, and I freely acknowledge that the decision to take military action and all of the stuff that has flowed from that decision divided, you know, the world, the nation, my party, my family, lots of families. And however, I came back from my visit to Iraq, and the conversations I had, particularly with the people I met in Basra and a woman that I met in Baghdad. Now, the woman I met in Baghdad was called Akima al-Hashimi, and I met her on a Thursday afternoon. She was a member of the Governing Council of Iraq, and she described to me what she and her fellow Governing Council members were seeking to do, to offer Iraq, after a generation of nightmare and brutality and trauma and murder, a better future. The following morning, she left her home to go to the donors' conference, and somebody shot her, and she died 5 days later. Now, she didn't have to do this job, but as it turned out, she put her life on the line to try and uphold certain values, which I certainly subscribe to, and I'm sure you do as well. But there are some people in Iraq who don't want that to happen. And we saw this week very clear evidence of that with the bombs which were set off during the Ashura festival. Now, the people I met in Basra were very critical of lots of things. They berated me for the slow pace of reconstruction. Now, things have improved since then, and I think the Iraqi people can begin to see that life, ordinary life, is beginning to get better. But they said, having berated me, by the way, in case you get the wrong impression, thank you very much for having got rid of him. And the truth is that a country in those circumstances, I think there's no question the people of Iraq are glad he's gone, may feel a certain ambivalence about the fact that it wasn't them who were capable of getting rid of him, but given his history, that's not surprising. Hate being occupied, but do they want the coalition troops to leave? The indications of opinion that we have demonstrate that that's not the case. And the truth is, trying to establish a functioning state with a democracy is not an easy task, and you have to start somewhere. And this week, we saw a very important sign in the progress of that process with the agreement of the transitional administrative law. And all I happen to think, even though I have great respect for people who took a contrary view, all I happen to think is, we live in a democracy where you can give me a really hard time, shout at me, vote me out, get rid of the Prime Minister if you want, because you want to elect a different government. And it's because we live in a country where you're free to do that. All I happen to think is that the Iraqi people deserve exactly the same right to do the same thing, something that's been denied them for the last 30 years. And our moral, as well as our political obligation, is to provide support now to help that process to happen. Now, the third question I was asked was about export control and arms exports. I think the first thing, yes, Kevin, excuse me, I'm being very presumptuous in calling people by their first names. Apologies. I think the first point I make is there are some people who take the view that, you know, nobody should have arms, nobody should sell arms to anybody. And I respect people who hold that view. It's not a view I happen to share, because I suppose the second question you have to ask is, do you accept that states have the right to defend themselves? I do. Our own history demonstrates why that's necessary. Therefore, you have to accept that states have the right to acquire the means to defend themselves. And after all, the first obligation of a state, in one sense, is to protect its people. Because if a state is attacked and its people aren't protected, people then tend to point the finger at the government and say, well, why the hell didn't you do something to stop this happening? So the question is, on what terms are we prepared as a manufacturer of arms, which we are, to license the sale of those arms to other countries. And that's what the Export Control Act that we now have in place does. And it does provide one of the toughest export control licensing regimes in the world. And it provides the means to refuse licenses on the grounds, for example, that those weapons will be used to oppress people. It also provides the opportunity to refuse licenses on the grounds that the expenditure of this money by a country will impact adversely on the sustainable development of that country. And it's based, as you know, on the EU consolidated criteria. And the proof of the effectiveness of the Act is obviously in the decisions that are made. And every year, the government reports to Parliament on the decisions that have been taken. The Quadripartite Committee looks at those and engages in a dialogue with ministers who take those decisions. Are you right when you say that the availability of weapons fuels conflict? Well, of course you're right. And one of the big challenges that we face in the world, particularly, is to do more to overcome the problem of small arms and light weapons. Because one of the consequences of the collapse of the Soviet Empire has been a flood of Kalashnikovs around Africa and other parts of the world. And the truth is we need to be more effective as an international community in dealing with those second-hand weapons, which are we see in the hands of those who are fighting in parts of Africa today.
Thanks. Now, time is marching on. I'm going to take one more round, I'm afraid, and I shall do it from the balcony. And the man right next to the steward there, the first one.
Emma Perez, LSE graduate.
Did I miss a question?
Yeah, you missed George's question.
Oh, I too terribly sorry. Can I?
Sorry, hold on one second. Oh, yeah.
I do apologise. This was about remittances. Yes. Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, nobody knows for sure how much is remitted back from migrant workers from developing countries back home. But I think the World Bank estimates it's about $80 billion a year, which is more than all of the aid which the rich world currently gives the developing world, which is about $50 billion a year. And I think it's been much neglected as a source of support and development finance. So I can't remember where you were sitting and asking the question. There you are at the back. Apologies, George. I think it's been much neglected. What can we do to help it work effectively? One of the things that we can do is to make it easier to send the money back, because some of the banks charge great big commission. There is, of course, the informal hawala system, which is a very sophisticated way of effecting money transfer. In some countries, they are using the ATM, you know, the automatic bank machine system, to give people who don't have bank accounts, but which allows them then, if they happen to live in a city where there is an ATM machine, to access the money that their relative has sent them from abroad. And I think it's also a very good example of the potential within the diaspora community in this country and elsewhere to see that we are there ways in which we could use the potential of that diaspora community, which is actually doing more than all of the rich world currently to support people back home, because they're sending back more money than we, the rich world, are giving in aid, to actually use that finance to support development back home.
Thanks. So three quick ones from the top. The one that was halfway aborted.
Hi, I'm Ahmed Pervez. I'm an old LSE graduate. My question for the Right Honourable Gentleman is, that does he not think it's hypocritical on behalf of the British government that the current president of Pakistan, who the West was even not willing to recognize until 9/11 and later unfortunate incidents, has certainly become the blue-eyed boy of the West? And what guarantee do the people of Pakistan have that he will not be isolated again, and the people will not be isolated when his utility finishes? And if the government thinks that democracy has been restored, why isn't Pakistan being led back into the Commonwealth? Thank you.
Thank you. One, yeah. A man in a blue shirt.
Yes, you mentioned the question of state intervention in crisis and state failure. I wonder what your government and Western governments as a whole think of the idea of intervention in crisis in places, for instance, Congo and Haiti was mentioned, and the fact that governments, with all the intelligence gathering they have around the world, choose not to intervene until the crisis has taken place, and the total chaos goes unreported in terms of Congo's 4 million people dying. And it's taken, 5 years for someone like the BBC to even have the idea of putting it to the world that this has gone on. It's like no one knows of it. But all of a sudden, the media decides it has to take someone to go outside the BBC's offices and the headquarters to have the report to the world of someone, the number of 4.5 million dying, and nothing is said about it. What has your government any policy to rectify that?
Thank you. I ought to point out the government isn't in direct control of the BBC yet. woman there, and that's going to be the last one, I'm afraid.
Thank you. Hello, my name is Dink, and I'm a second year anthropology student at the LSE. I was wondering if your government is going to make a more concentrated effort to fight the AIDS and HIV crisis in the world.
Yep.
Because I think that is the most important problem that faces development and also state failure, and is also something that facilitates state failure and cannot never lead to development. And I also wonder if you're going to make a more concentrated effort to install the production of generically manufactured antiretroviral drugs in the sub-Saharan African area, because that is the part of the world where they are needed most, and that is the only way that they can actually combat this huge problem that I have.
Yep.
Thank you very much.
The first question was about Pakistan. As far as Pakistan's membership of the Commonwealth is concerned, the Commonwealth set, as I'm sure you know, various benchmarks that needed to be achieved in order to start the process of enabling Pakistan to return to the Commonwealth. And the Commonwealth Ministerial Action Group will now be looking at Pakistan, in particular, in the light of the agreement that was reached, I think, just after Christmas, which has dealt with the constitutional standoff, one of the consequences of which is that the system of devolution of power within Pakistan is now going to be secure, I think, from memory, until 2009. We have an increasing development programme, just speaking for DFID, in the UK, in Pakistan. I was there just after Christmas. And I think really the striking issue in Pakistan for me is this, that if you take Pakistan, Bangladesh and Nepal, and if you ask people, can you just rank them in order, you know, how well do they perform on enrollment in primary education, maternal mortality, child mortality? Now the truth is Pakistan does less well than Bangladesh, and Pakistan does less well than Nepal. And one of the reasons, based on the people I spoke to, is that question, to what extent has the political system, the political parties within Pakistan, worried about the fact that there are high levels of maternal and child mortality? Now, we're working particularly with two states, Northwest Frontier Province and Punjab, and one of the things that we're now going to do in the light of the devolution of power to district level from the provinces is to say, should we be doing more work as DFID in our expanded program at the district level, in the hope of supporting those who are wanting to change the situation in Pakistan, because Pakistan has a long way to go to meet the Millennium Development Goals in those two particular areas. That's the first thing. The second question was about state intervention, Congo and Haiti. Well, you're absolutely right about the BBC, because it was not until the BBC went into Bunia, as I said, in the summer of last year, that the world, or certainly the world here, began to understand what was happening in that country, and that led to political pressure, and the European force went in, led by the French, supported by the British, helped to stabilize the situation in Bunia. Monarch has now, the UN force has been deploying more to the east of the country, but there's still a big problem with fighting and conflict there. When I talked about building African capacity, one of the reasons I think it really matters is because it's examples like the DRC where we would need that capacity to be used. And I say in all honesty, if the world, when intervention is required, looks to a relatively small number of countries to do it, and the world has looked at the UK, the US and others, then one country, however well-intentioned or well-equipped, can't do it all. And that's why I think we do need to build more capacity at continent level, at regional level, to actually do something about these crises before they get to the form that it's taken in the DRC. And finally, on AIDS, HIV, what are we doing? What have we done? Since 1997, we have increased our funding from the UK development budget to fight HIV AIDS sevenfold.
In 1997, the UK was spending bilaterally on AIDS programs and reproductive health £38 million a year. Last year, we spent £270 million a year. And according to UNAIDS, which is leading the fight on behalf of the UN, the UK is the second largest bilateral donor in the fight against HIV/AIDS in the world after the United States, which is the first. The second thing we're doing is putting funding into the Global Fund, $280 million between now and 2008. What's the third thing that the world needs to do? Well, one, it needs to raise more resources. Secondly, we need to emphasize the importance of strong political leadership in fighting the epidemic. Uganda, Senegal, really good examples of what you can do by stopping people getting the virus in the first place. We've got to talk openly about it. We've got to make condoms available. An official told me the other day that I asked the question, how many condoms has DFID helped to fund? Because we are big supporters of social marketing efforts to make condoms available. And she said, well, we've had a count, and we think it's about 491 million. And they're still working out exactly over what period of time that figure applies. But I make the point that that's a really practical contribution, because it's a very effective way of preventing you from getting the HIV virus. We need to care for people who are HIV positive. We need to make treatment more available. And there is an opportunity now with the price of the antiretrovirals coming down. There is provision within the TRIPS agreement for countries to compulsorily license and therefore manufacture on a generic basis antiretrovirals, because AIDS is undoubtedly a public health emergency, and the TRIPS agreement permits that to happen. So we need more money in the system, we need more political leadership, we need more treatment, we need greater openness, and the first thing that we need is that all of this effort, more money in the international system, will to help, is used in a way that helps developing country governments to actually tackle the problem. Because the worst thing is if we all turn up in a country and knock on the door and I say, hi, I'm from the UK, I've got some money, I want to help, here's our program, can you report on how you spent it? And then the Dutch do the same, and then the Norwegians, and then the Swedish, and then the Global Fund. Actually, you place a great burden on the capacity. And that's why we have a mantra that we shout, three ones. One policy for dealing with AIDS in a country, one body responsible for doing it, and one way of reporting on the progress. And our responsibility, moral, political, and financial, is to put in the cash to support that approach, because actually that's the most effective way that we can help tackle this terrible scourge that's doing so much damage to so many people.
Thank you. Before we close, I have three very quick things to do. First is to apologise to those people whose questions I couldn't take. There were a lot more, and all I can say is we did our best, and the Secretary of State did extend beyond the time we'd agreed. Secondly, a short commercial. Some of you may have seen outside that there's a table with some literature on which Jude Howell is promoting. Jude is the director of the Centre of Civil Society here, and is running the London Marathon in aid of a charity called Concern, which helps landmine victims in Cambodia. And anyone who feels disposed to help that excellent cause may pick up a leaflet outside as they go. Lastly, of course not least, thank you very much to Hilary Benn for coming and taking the questions. I think you can see how much you are appreciated. I only have one concern, that Hilary's private secretary, or at least the private secretary he had until this evening, was from the LSE, and obviously did not warn him what he could expect. So you'll be looking for a new private secretary tomorrow, quite sure. But also, finally, 491 million condoms is very, very impressive for one man. Thank you.